This is Bigger Than the Game with Deremy Dove and Jose Ruiz.
Welcome to Bigger Than the Game with Deremy and Jose. I'm Deremy Dove, and I'm joined by my co-host, my tag team partner, the one and only Jose Ruiz. What's going on?
Deremy Dove, what's up, my brother? How you doing, man?
I'm doing great, man. How are you?
I'm good, man. I'm good. Preseason football started today. Got a lot going on, man. It's a fun time.
It really is. It's
100,000 degrees outside.
It's really hot. It's summer. We're feeling it right now. I was getting comfortable with the cool weather last week, and someone said, "Nope, don't ever get comfortable."
Nope. No, but it's a good time. Like, good time in sports right now, man.
It is, and it's crazy. We were going over it last week. It's been since March. We had a football episode.
Something like that, yeah.
The Drew Brees one was the last one, which I didn't think it was that long, but
yeah,
we've had so many changes and things happening, with our show and just in the world of sports. So it feels good, like you said, training camp starting, Hard Knocks that debuted. So it's good to get back into a football episode.
Yeah, no, this has been in the books for a little while too. This fits right into what we do here at the show with this topic here. But yeah, we needed to get into some football for sure.
Because it's always interesting because this is, we think about this person. He's someone who, he does interviews. He's a broadcaster. And usually that's what you need, that post-life to kind of keep your legacy going and to kind of stay, in that people's minds of, greatness and how great he is. But it's still, and I'll give you credit because you suggested this episode. And I was like, yeah, he's the perfect guy because it's kind of like people just say his name and oh, he's a Hall of Famer and keep it moving.
Yeah.
But there's so much to this person. There's so much to his story, his legacy, and his greatness that I feel like gets overlooked.
Definitely, man. And again, growing up, this was one of the guys who I looked at wow, he was just different, just from, obviously, we'll get into everything, but just looking at a person of color playing the position of quarterback, and that was just different for me, right? That was good to see and fun to watch. And, we grew up and we were just talking about Randall and, Doug Williams was a little bit before us, but, I still got to watch him play in the Super Bowl. And, now this is not even, this is what you see mostly. But, yeah, when I saw Warren Moon play, I was like, wow, this is something totally different. And it was really, really fun to watch. So, yeah, with this episode, what we're going to dive into today is obviously, the great career of Warren Moon.
Yeah, and we're going to be, because, Warren Moon played for so long.
90 years, yeah.
So we're looking at just that time before and during, with the Houston Oilers. Because that's really, when you look at his career and also, probably his most productive.
Oh, yeah.
And also the closest chance he had at a Super Bowl was those years in Houston with that run-and-shoot offense, which is really ahead of its time.
Oh, yeah, and then that was one something I will get into, what we'll get into later on. But, yeah, he had a couple good years in Minnesota. He had that one Pro Bowl season in Seattle. But, yeah, we'll be here 4 hours if we're covering his whole career. But, yeah, that run he had in Houston was an all-time great run. He was only second in that span to the all-time great Dan Marino. That's saying a lot. Ahead of his time, for sure. That offense was ahead of his time. I'll get into this. You look at the numbers he put up 90, 91, 92. You can put those up with guys now,
He was out-dueling Marino those years.
Yes.
He was better than Marino, honestly, in my opinion, in those years. And you look at it, and it's really something because, like you said, we did an episode on Randall. Check those archives.
Check them.
And we're doing one on Warren Moon, and there's Doug. And those three really kind of laid the foundation for what we see today with black quarterbacks. Now, there was black quarterbacks before Warren and Doug and Randall in the 80s, from James Harris, Joe Gillum, Marlon Briscoe. But it really was – these were the guys who fought through all that adversity and said, I'm playing quarterback. I'm not going to play receiver. You're not going to move me. We're going to stay at quarterback. And people – it kind of gets overstated or overlooked now. Warren Moon, he's the first black quarterback in the Hall of Fame. And it kind of reminds me of what, John Thompson always said. He didn't want to be the first black anything because that's such a misleading quote, making it seem like there weren't black people before who could have done this. He was just given that opportunity. And that's how I feel with Warren Moon. He's the first black quarterback in the Hall of Fame, but that's very misleading because there were other quarterbacks who had that ability but just weren't given that opportunity.
Yeah, and he And this was another guy you just talked about it. Like, he was, you know, he wasn't recruited in college, right? Because nobody wanted to play him at quarterback. I think Arizona State offered him, you know, that he can play defensive back, and he said absolutely not. And, you know, we all know the career path that Warren Moon took. You know, University of Washington, and he goes to the CFL. He has to go to the CFL to become a starting quarterback, you know, and mm-hmm. then becomes the first real free agent ever in the NFL. So, I mean, it's so much to his career that it's like he's the first of this, the first of that. And it doesn't really get talked about a lot. And he's not a guy that you go to when you talk about these quarterbacks in the 90s. You always go to the, you know, the super Hall of Fame superstar quarterbacks, the Elway Marinos, the Montanas. Rightfully so, they were great players. But this is a guy who needs to be up there and talked about just as much.
Absolutely. And, you know, Zach, I remember this, like you said, it's been in the works for a while wanting to do this. And I sent you, like, a list of, like, the greatest quarterbacks.
Yep.
And I remember it had, like, Matt Ryan over Warren Moon.
Yeah, it's nuts.
And it was, like, USA Today, like, something big. And I was just like, this is why we do this show. Because, you know, you get stuff like that. And then it's like, you know, imagine we didn't have this podcast, man. And it's, I had to just sit there in my anger just seeing Matty Ice is above Warren Moon. Matty Ice.
That dude, yeah.
You know, like, come on now.
And,
like,
and that's why I wanted to say that, because, you know, it'll be really, like, very easy for us to come in and do a show on John Elway and Joe Montana and, you know, like, Vince Lombardi, like, all those old school guys who, like, everybody talks about. But what I love about our show, Jeremy, is that we talk about the guys who deserve to be mentioned in these, like, conversations when you talk about all-time greats. And, you know, you can't talk about Houston Oilers football without talking about Warren Moon. Like, what he did in Houston, what that whole team did, you know, some say underachieved, but, man, they had a great, great run.
It was. It was very exciting. And the thing is, you look back, like you said, he wasn't really recruited coming out of high school into college, winds up going to the University of Washington, winds up leading his senior year, gets them to the Rose Bowl, which, you know, the Rose Bowl is a big deal today, but I think people don't realize how big of a deal it was back, even, like, you know, this is in 77,
yep.
But, like, in that era, like, 60s, 70s, even when we were growing up, like, the 90s, Rose Bowl was, like, as Keith Jackson, the granddaddy of them all.
Yeah, man.
So it was something special, like, and for him on that biggest stage, where he, at that point, you know, it's only three networks, so you know the whole country is watching.
Absolutely.
And him to upset Michigan, the Maize and Blue, you know, Bo Schembechler, big deal. And yet people still said no. People did not want to draft him coming out of the, you know, going into the 78 NFL draft.
Yeah, and that Michigan team was pretty good, too. Like, so it's not like, and they were heavily favored. So it's not like he went in there and, you know, the University of Washington was just as good as Michigan. They were not. And he single-handedly put that Washington, that University of Washington Husky team on his back and willed them. And he scored a couple of rushing touchdowns to a nice touchdown pass. Like, he had a great game, MVP of the game, you know, and still has to go to the CFL, does not get drafted. Now, he did declare he was going to CFL, was it like 6 weeks before the draft? So maybe that had a part in it, but still does not get drafted by any team.
That didn't have a part. Let's be honest. I don't think it had a part because, you know, his agent at the time, you know, was a legendary agent.
Yeah.
Lee Steinberg said it, like, teams were asking, like, for him to switch positions.
Switch positions, yep.
And Warren Moon stuck to his guns. And especially, you got to look at it, and I don't think people, you know, I like that we do this, like, for, don't get me wrong, it's about, the greatness on the court or on the field, whatever sport, but we have to look at, for those who just changed the culture, changed the game like that.
Oh, yeah.
When Warren Moon's saying, I'm going to play a quarterback, he doesn't have an example of, to look at, you know, honestly. You know, at that point in the late 70s, you know, Joe Gillum's out of football. Marlon Briscoe was a quarterback with Denver, got switched to play receiver with those perfect Dolphins teams in the early 70s. James Harris started for some games and then was a backup. He doesn't have that example of, oh, yeah, this quarterback who had that long career and was consistent and he was the franchise guy. He's sticking to his guns and not knowing if he will get that. He's hoping. He believes in himself, but there's no standard. There's nothing there for him to look at and say, I'm going to have a career path like so-and-so. He is the trailblazer. And at that time, it's interesting because in the 78 draft, we got to look at it, Doug Williams was taken.
He's in the first round, yeah.
And I think that's interesting because people want to put that up. Well, how come Doug Williams got drafted? And Doug Williams wound up going to Tampa Bay, who was a laughingstock. He had John McKay, who the only reason John McKay was okay with it, A, because Tampa was that bad, but also B, he had a black quarterback in the 60s at USC when John McKay was coaching the Trojans. And C, a thing that wound up coming back huge later, the offensive coordinator that year, the only guy to work out Doug Williams was Joe Gibbs.
Man, I know. And look what happened there, right? Like, so let's look at that 70 draft real quick.
Yeah.
I just wanted to pull up the quarterbacks who were drafted in that year. Doug Williams, obviously, we all know what Doug Williams did. But you have Matt Kavanaugh, Guy Benjamin, Mark Miller, Guilford Nielsen. He sounds like a hockey player. Pete Woods, who never played a down from Kansas. Mark Mangus. I don't know. Rob Hart. I can't even say these names. Like, Pat Ryan. He played for the Eagles in 91. I couldn't stand that dude for like three games. Like, these quarterbacks, like, you know, none of them had good careers. And you
I like Doug.
I mean, yeah, obviously. But, yeah, I kind of, like, left him out of that. But, like, you mean to tell me, like, Warren Moon, especially the career, it's not like he didn't have a good career in Washington. Like, he only played a couple seasons because he had to go to, like, a junior college. But he had two really good seasons. If any of these other guys, any of these other quarterbacks, or let's just say Washington's quarterback, was not African-American, and he was the MVP of the Rose Bowl, he would have been drafted. You know what I'm saying? So, like, that just blew my mind when I started looking at these names and of these guys being drafted. It's insane.
No, and that was always the standard, you know. Up the middle, quarterback, center, middle linebacker, those were positions that, you know, that was white only at that time. You know, Harry Carson, Hall of Fame middle linebacker, great for the Giants, said when he got drafted, he got drafted in 76 out of South Carolina State. And he said, you know, Marty Schottenheimer was his defensive coach at the time with the Giants. And every week he had to do IQ tests to prove his intelligence.
Yeah, which is
that's what
bullshit.
Harry Carson, exactly. And we know who Harry Carson was and who he became, Hall of Famer. But that was the knock at the time. Those three positions that you had to use, quote unquote, intelligence.
Yep.
And that was white only.
Yeah, and that's why they were quick to change Warren Moon's position, like to wide receiver, defensive back. You know, it's insane, man. Like, if you think about, like, you know, what they had to go through back in, you know, the late 70s, early 80s, you know, and we can keep talking, like, 90s, like, today.
To this day, yeah.
You know, and, but, like, for how great he was and for him not even to get drafted and have to go to the CFL, to play, man, which to me is still, like, I was doing all this, like, I already know about Warren Moon's career, but, like, just looking back and really digging into it, I just felt terrible, man.
Yeah, it's a shame. And, you know, let's make it, you know, this show, Bigger Than the Game, connects the past to the present. Ozzie Newsome's last first round draft pick was Lamar Jackson in that great QB draft, you know, Baker, Josh Allen. Lamar's at the end of the first round. And what were people saying then? Heisman Trophy winner, all that. Change his position. Not a quarterback. So it's to show people, like, yes, we've come far, but we've had so far to go.
Absolutely.
So far to go with this. And the fact that, like, boom, you have someone who believes in this quarterback and his ability. He's an MVP. Lamar Jackson is that. But it's not, so people want to say, well, that was back then. No, that's still to this day that this is happening.
Absolutely. And then you can even hear, like, even, like, the tangibles they point out. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's like all these little things. Like, he's a great athlete. Like, you know, he's a great runner. Like, no. Like, this dude was in Louisville throwing it all over. Yes, he can run, but he was throwing it all over the field too, man. You know?
But Josh Allen can run.
Exactly.
You know?
But that's a great, you know, like, he can make plays with his legs. Like, mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Like, there's difference on how you're labeled as a quarterback depending on your race, man, which is, it's still, I keep saying it. It blows my mind, man.
No, and it's funny because I never thought about this, but with Warren went to the Edmonton Eskimos, and, you know, I like hockey, but Jose's a bigger hockey fan. You know, we think of Edmonton Oilers, but that's not the first dynasty.
No.
You know, these Eskimos beat the Oilers out here. You know, Warren Moon, 5 Grey Cup titles in a row.
In a row. Yeah, and I mean, he went to a good team. I think they were just about to win the Grey Cup. He didn't really play that first year, but still, like, you know what happened after that. Like, those next 4 years, he was lights out. And that was – and you can't – then you really can't – at this point, you can't deny this man. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, he's putting up gaudy numbers. He's throwing for 5,600 yards. I think that last season he played in the CFL. Like, those numbers he was putting up, like, you could not compare them to anybody in the NFL. Like, I know the CFL and NFL is totally different leagues, but, like, what this dude was doing in the CFL, now you couldn't ignore him anymore. So now it's to the point where, like, all right, I'm going to go play in the NFL. He has the ability to pick his own team, which is awesome. Like, that was the best part of him not being drafted. Nobody owned his rights.
Right.
So now he can go to any team. Not only did he go to the Houston Oilers, but he was the highest paid player in the NFL. I think it was like $5.6 million in his contract. And, man, like, that had to sting a lot of people at that point. I don't give a shit. It was 84? Like, that still had to sting a lot of people.
Oh, we know it. We know it to be true. And surprised that it was Bud Adams who was shelling out that kind of money for him. But, you know, Bud Adams did. And it's funny. I think you said Gifford Nielsen, and he was a quarterback. He was the quarterback for the Oilers going into that 83 year, but he retired after Warren joined the team, stating that Moon becoming the quarterback's inevitable. So he
said, I'm out.
He said, I'm done. I'm out. I'm nah. It should have happened 5 years earlier, but no.
Yeah.
I'm done. So to me, it's awesome. Like, Warren has some struggles early on, but where the Oilers of the 80s get interesting and fun, and it's funny because you can also check our archives, you have those 85 Bears that are fun and, like, a wild bunch in the 80s. We talked about, check our archives again, with the, you know, Buddy Ryan in the 80s and the Eagles. But Jerry Glanville coming to Houston in 86.
Yeah.
And really kind of bringing that renegade to, like, that style to the AFC Central. The Oilers kind of became, to me, I think you can look at, like, Buddy and the Eagles in that NFC
in
East.
In the NFC, yeah.
And then the Oilers with Jerry Glanville in the AFC. Because, you know, you had, like, you look at Cleveland with Marty Schottenheimer. Pittsburgh had Chuck Knoll.
Man.
Cincinnati had Sam Weiss. All these, you know, kind of like, especially with Marty and Chuck Knoll, these, like, just button-down, like, coaches. And then you got Jerry Glanville, who's preaching aggressiveness, preaching late hits, dirty ball. He's leaving tickets for Elvis for the game. I love Jerry. That's a great person. I love Jerry Glanville. Always dressed in black.
He was fun. Yeah, he was definitely fun. And people always remember him, like, in the early 90s Falcons team.
Yeah.
It was the same thing in Houston, you know, just a lot soon, like, a lot earlier than that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he started building what we now know was the run and shoot offense and all those wide receivers, you know. You know, because that was, what, 87 you're talking about. You know, 86, they draft Ernest Givens. 87, Haywood Jeffries. 88, Lorenzo White, Chris Dishman. Like, they're building this team now through Jerry Glanville. And what he brought that, when he brought that run and shoot offense, it just changed everything for Warren Moon.
Now, that offense was explosive, but let's be real. When I think of the 80s Oilers and their offense, I'm thinking of Warren Moon.
Yep.
And you got two Hall of Famers on the O-line. You got Bruce Matthews, one of the great all-time offensive linemen ever.
He might be, if I had to pick a starting O-line all-time, he's on there.
Yeah, he's part of that mix. He's up there. And Mike Munchak.
Another beast.
Hall of Famer. But the skill position guys, I know we know them because we this is what we do. We live for this shit. But, like,
sadly.
Yeah, this is all we do. We do nothing else.
Nope.
But no, people wouldn't be, even people who were around who love, like, you know, old school football, probably can't name the receivers who Warren Moon was throwing to at that era. You know, you say Ernest Givens, Drew Hill, Webster Slaughter.
Drew Hill, not the music group.
Not the group. No. Not the group. Not Cisco.
No.
No, we're talking about D-R-E-W Hill. Like, it's a totally different bunch. Haywood Jeffries.
Yeah.
You know? And it's funny because I'm like, were these guys pro? But they were pro bowlers.
Haywood Jeffries was for sure, especially in this. I know we're going to get into the 93 season a little bit as well. You know, probably Moon's best shot to get in the Super Bowl. But, yeah, 93, they had, like, 9 pro bowlers. Like, so, yeah, you're right. Like, what he's doing with these receivers. And then, you know, a lot of, like, Philly fans, like, we have a lot of listeners in Philadelphia always remember that, like, that House of Pain game.
Yeah.
When Buddy was I don't even think that was Buddy's team.
I think it was 91. Coach's first year.
Yeah. Like, you know, when the Eagles were laying out all these receivers, like, that's what it was. They were a bunch of little guys. Ernest Givens was really small, dude. Haywood Jeffries was a big receiver, but that was about it.
Yeah.
They were all just quick, you know, like, get to the open spots, boom, and Warren Moon was just hitting them all over the place. So, yeah, like, he wasn't throwing to, you know, later on, he has Chris Carter, you know, and then that had me thinking, not to switch it up too much, but say he goes to Seattle and he's got Steve Largent now, like, you know what I'm saying? Like, and that would have been a nice combination.
That would have been a great combo.
Yeah, like that that would have almost made me go to Seattle if I was a Warren Moon, but whatever. But, yeah, you're right, though. I agree. Like, these are decent receivers, but they're not, like, all-time great
No,
guys.
I feel like they're a product of this, you know, run and shoot. Because the run and shoot, a big key to it was, and I'm glad, Jose, you brought it up, you know, like you said, Hayward Jeffries was big, but you wanted small, quick receivers to get out there.
Yep.
You know, Detroit kind of had something like that later on.
In
like,
the early 90s.
So you wanted, like, these quick receivers, and then you wanted a really big running back who can really, you know, pound it up the middle, but also help, you know,
pass protect
for the quarterback. So that's where it was kind of, like, very different. And it's not the same as Chip Kelly's offense, but it kind of reminds me of, like, a forerunner for that, where it's, like, you know, we kind of knocked Chip Kelly with, like, no ball control and go, go, go. And even if you have a lead, you want to run the clock out and you're not giving your defense that rest. And that was kind of the knock on the run and shoot back in the 80s was – you know, it was different, but it was also, which we know in all sports, but definitely the NFL, especially in the 80s, anything that was different that wasn't just power, 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 people were like, what the hell is this? But it there were some knocks with it too, to be fair.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, like, the difference, I would say, to use that comparison with Chip Kelly's offense, Chip Kelly ran the ball a lot. You know what I mean? Like, and these guys did not. You know what I'm saying? Like, I think, you know, you had, again, Lorenzo Neal. He was a nice running back, bigger guy, can catch the ball out of the backfield too for a big guy. But they never could, and this is going to lead up to some devastating losses. Like, they can never put teams away because they cannot run the ball and control the clock. You know, especially at this era of football, like, if you have a 10-13-point lead, 17-point lead, and you're still throwing the ball in the fourth quarter, that gives the team an opportunity to come back on you. You know, that's turnovers, sacks, or, again, the three and outs, whatever the case may be. You have to be able, you have to have the ability to run the ball, kill the clock, and put teams away. And this comes to haunt this Oilers teams for sure.
Yeah. So we'll say it later. But, you know, Buddy Ryan called it Chuck and Duck.
Chuck and Duck.
Chuck, you know, which kind of was a good staple for it for a while. But
yeah.
I don't know. I don't knock Warren for those, like, losses, though. It was, to me, like, not having that coaching to put it up and to set it up. I think Warren Moon is the kind of a talent would have done well in any offense, and he would have had big numbers in any offense.
Yeah.
You know, but I do look at whether it was Jerry Glanville and later on, you know, it goes to Jack Pardee and Kevin Gilbride, but it was just like you need it. And I will say I agree, Chip Kelly ran the ball more. I think he didn't run it enough, and I think he didn't run the clock out.
Yeah.
But, like, Chip did do it more than what the run-and-shoot Oilers did in the 80s. But you see, like, you know, we heard it before we came in here. Like, people think the run game is, like, it's dead, but it's still important.
No,
you still need
dead.
It. You know, it's still needed in this league now, and definitely was back then.
Yeah, I think five of the top, like, 10 teams last year were, you know, teams who led the league, like, were up there in rushing yards. So I wouldn't say the running game is dead. I just didn't want to get into that conversation. But I agree, man. Like, I think the league obviously goes in phases, right? Like, people want to just throw the ball everywhere. Now I think, like, the pattern has turned back to, like, running the game, controlling the clock. Because you can do so much just off the running game. You know, you can wear a team down. Like, you barely hear that anymore. Growing up, when I was growing up, that's all you heard. You know, let's just pound the ball and wear these teams down, play action. Then you can go deep. But with this run-and-shoot offense, they weren't doing any of that. It was more like those, like, angle rollouts, which I really loved. They looked pretty cool.
Yeah,
like,
they did.
You know, like those soft rollouts Warren Moon was doing. And, you know, he was just turning around and, it's, you know, just boom, boom, just hitting, throwing darts, man, at wide receivers. And so, again, like, you can have a great passing game, which they obviously had, but you have to, you know, you got to have the ability to slow that ball game down and just run the clock out. Like, you see teams that can do that today. But, again, these Oilers teams could not do that.
And you can say early on in that run when they started becoming a playoff team, the defense kind of was – it was always aggressive.
Yeah.
Not the most disciplined.
No.
But they had their struggles too. And that was kind of a big thing. The defense was also going to let you down in the end, especially when it came to playoff time.
Oh, yeah. And we know that. Like, in 92, we all know what happened up in Buffalo with that. Probably it was the biggest comeback of all time. And, again, like, everybody looks at Warren Moon and this offense. But, you know, They weren't playing defense, and it was a lot of Bills wide receivers running down the field wide open. Andre Reed, Don Beebe, they were killing those Oilers teams, but that Oilers team in that game. But you look at that game again, going back to what we were just talking about. If Houston can run the ball, you know, you're taking all those, you know, opportunities away from the Bills. They just couldn't do that, you know. In the game we're going to talk about, they couldn't run the ball.
No,
that killed them. You know what I mean? Like, so. It always boils down to what can you do. And we talked about up front how great they were up front. They had a really, really good offensive line. They had a rookie, Brad Hawkins, in 93. He turned out to be a really good left tackle. He didn't have a good game in that 93 game we're going to talk about.
We know why.
Yeah, that's – yeah, I'll get into that too, which was like they did him wrong. But anyway, like they had a solid offensive line. I don't know what it was, man. Like they could just never generate that. And they had 1,000-yard rushers. It was just never consistent.
I think it was, it's so huge. We talk about it, and you know, we can go on and on this show, but
yes, we can.
The importance of having that coaching, having that structure.
Yep.
Because that's what you need a lot of times. Those who are going to keep everyone on the same page. You know, no different than anything else. A team. You know, we're talking football. Talk, keep it to football. It's a delicate balance there. And just because you have a lot of talented players, if you don't keep them all on that same page, same goal, trying to make sure to get these different personalities, especially in a football team where there's so many guys in a locker room, make sure that they're all on accord, not having division like that, not pointing fingers or not blaming the other in the media, it can take a season and just turn it left real quick. And then everyone has Super Bowl expectation before the year, and then during the season afterwards, you go, what the hell happened? And we've seen it so many times, and these Oilers are maybe some of the best examples that we don't talk about, but maybe some of the best examples ever of how it's not just about the talent, it's how you guys work as a cohesive unit.
Absolutely, and I think you mentioned it, like coaching. I think, for me, it starts with the head coach, right? Like, what kind of stamp is he putting on this team? Now, we talked about Jerry Glanville, who had some success in the NFL, but he was one of those coaches that can never get over the top. He was always, you know, innovative, in your face. He was a great interview.
Great interview.
Great NFL film clips. You know, NFL stands for not for long. Like, that's you know, he's got a lot of those clips. But, you know, you got to have the ability. You can be a player's coach, which is fine, but you also have to find a way. You have to, like, draw that line in the sand where you can't let players cross. And he was one of those coaches where players did whatever they want. We look at this team, especially at Atlanta's team. Like, so now, you know, later on, you know, this Houston team starts adding these coaches like Buddy Ryan, Kevin Gilbride, like Jack Pardee. It looked like he was just there. You know what I'm saying? Like, he had no control of this team. These assistant coaches had a little more power than he did. And it was just like, who do you go to? Who's the main guy here?
Mm-hmm.
And for me, also, with these very tough losses that this Houston Oilers team suffered in the early 90s, it's like I go immediately to the head coach, because I don't think, like, you know, a Jimmy Johnson team is going to lose a 35-3 lead.
Hell no.
You know, like Joe Gibbs, Bill Parcells, like all these great coaches. Now, we're talking about all-time great coaches, but, you know, I don't even think a Marty Schottenheimer team is going to give up a 35-3 lead. Like, it's not going to happen.
No.
So quickly, you get into, like, When that starts to steamroll like that, like, your head coach needs to stop that. And this is where this team had tons of talent, but that's where
they lacked. Well, that's where I blame Bud Adams, the
absolutely,
owner in the front
absolutely.
Office, because let's be real, it's starting from about 88 all the way building up to 93 season.
Yep.
You're having tough playoff losses that shouldn't have happened. You know, you have a tough one in 88 in the divisional. You lose to Buffalo. The next year, you're 8-9. I mean, you're 9-7, but you have a home game. Pittsburgh did. I think they won one division game that year.
Yeah, they weren't that good.
Pittsburgh comes in. You swept them during the season. Bubby Brister is the quarterback.
Yeah.
And Chuck Noll is really patching up a team. Merrill Hodge runs all over you. Freaking Hodge.
Yeah.
You know, and you get beat in your own backyard by that squad. It just kept going, and then you have to look at it, that 90, that's where it all starts. And it's funny because, like, who had I'm thinking a worse calendar year, because it's the 92 Oilers, but it's like January of 93, and you're going into Rich Stadium, you know, Jose's favorite team, those Buffalo Bills. Jose loves.
I did love those Bills. I don't
favorite
give a
player,
shit.
Thurman Thomas.
That was my guy.
You know, but
the best all-around back of all time.
Wow. No. Don't make me have a heart attack on our podcast here, but I'll say this. You're going into that game, and Jim Kelly's out. Yeah. Cornelius Bennett's also out, too.
Biscuit Bennett.
Biscuit Bennett. So you have a lot of big names for these guys that are out.
Important names, obviously.
Important names. And you're up 35-3, and you blow it. And one of just... It still is like, I don't know, I think the Falcons and Matty Ice kind of eased a little burden off of them because that's the Super Bowl.
Yeah,
I think that's the only reason. For so long, 35-3 was known. And you could say it to anybody, they knew what you were talking about, and that collapse, that choke job. I think the Falcons a few years ago to the Patriots kind of took the heat off of the Oilers.
Yeah, it did because it was in the Super Bowl. Yeah. I mean, but you're also doing that, losing to Tom Brady and a dynasty team in the Patriots. Like, the Bills were a mini dynasty. They didn't get over that hump. But I'm just waiting for the joke.
No, I'm just letting you, hey, talk about the Bills, you know.
I'm going to talk about them. So,
hey, I know, I can't wait. We're going to have probably 12 hours straight one day about just Bills, not those 90s Bills.
I can probably do that. So, it was just, I remember watching that game, man, and I left. Right after Bubba McDowell ran that interception back, we went to play a little football, came back, and it was like they were like down three. And I was like, oh my, like it just blew my mind. But like, man, like you can't give up that. You can't lose in the game like that. And not only were they up 35-3, but they were crushing them. Like they couldn't stop the Oilers. It was just a, and I know we hate to use this word. It was like an all-time choke job. You know what I'm saying? And again, coaching has to kind of like get that together. But also, you're in Buffalo, like, you know, the weather is terrible. You can't go up there trying to throw 46 passes a game. Like, it's just not going to work. Even though it worked in the first half, it's just not going to work. This game that we're going to talk about, this 93 playoff game, same thing. It worked in the first half. The second half did not work. Like, it's just, you have to have the ability to kind of adjust. And every team adjusts to them, they just never can never adjust as well.
Yeah, and I don't you know, Warren Moon is in this time, he's throwing his ass off. He's leading the league.
Absolutely.
He's first team all pro. And Jose mentioned, and you go into the early 90s, the names, you know, Steve Young's emerging. You have Elway, you have Marino, you have Jim Kelly, you have these guys who are legit, and Warren Moon is the guy. He's the name that you're seeing. Randall's there. You know, so many guys are you know, we're starting to see the evolution of the NFL offices we see today. To me, I look back, there's two guys, I'll say three guys who really laid down that blueprint in the 80s, and then the 90s, it kind of exploded. But in the 80s, it's Dan Fouts.
Yep.
It's Dan Marino, two guys named Dan, and Warren Moon. Those guys were the ones who aired it out in these classic offenses that, you know, for people now, it's like, oh, yeah, he almost got 5,000 yards, no big deal. Well, back in the 80s, you weren't seeing people get 4,000 yards.
Yeah, that 3,000 yards was a big deal. Yeah. Like, that was a good season. For context, right, let's look at his 90s season real quick. You know, 362 completions on 584 attempts, right? 62% completion percentage. All right, whatever. He throws for 4,689 yards, right? This is 1990. For context, Deshaun Watson led the league in passing in 2020 with 4,823 yards. So he was right there with these guys today. Yeah. You know, that following season.
30 years before.
Yeah, he throws for another 4,690. You know, like, he could play today easily and put up way more better numbers than what he was putting up back then. And this is a time where you can hit these quarterbacks. You know, like, you can hit these receivers. It was a different game, and he's putting up these type of numbers, 33 touchdowns in 1990. Like, he was like, and the ball he threw, and you always hear about, like, that pretty ball, pretty spiral. He threw the best ball I've ever seen.
Yeah,
like, hands down.
Yeah.
Aikman is there, too, with him. Aikman threw a pretty ball, but this Warren Moon ball, like, this, it was a beautiful, like, NFL Films does a beautiful job, like, just with the slow motion rotation. It was beautiful, man. Like, he was a pure passer. That gets thrown around so much. This guy was one of them.
Which is important because I think you shouldn't have to do this, but as a black quarterback, he showed the different it wasn't just, you know, we have, don't get me wrong, we love Randall and he got knocked. He was innovative and amazing to watch, but it wasn't just, you know, oh, he's scrambling, right? It wasn't scrambling Warren. It was Warren Moon. Hey, he's dropping back like these other quarterbacks in the league, and he's out-dueling them. He's out-gunning these guys. He's the gunslinger. You know, he's in Houston.
Yeah.
He's a cowboy. He's gunslinging everybody down. And that, to me, you look at it, and no knock on that bunch, you know, with Ernest Givens and Hayward Jeffries. They put up numbers in this offense, but we look at it, I have to say it, they weren't anything after that.
Oh, no, absolutely not.
So, to me, that's a product. If they would have been successful every other place, it's like, okay. But it's like, to me, that's a product of Warren Moon. Really, he's the guy keeping this offense going. And under that kind of pressure, because, you know, we've heard it. They did a football life on Warren Moon, a football life on Houston 93. And under that pressure, being who he is, they said Warren couldn't go out and get a drink. He couldn't do this. He had to be perfect.
Yeah, perfect family life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He had to give that image because, you know, a lot of quarterbacks do go through that. Back then and today, you are like a representation of the team. You're that head guy,
like the corporate or look, organizational, yeah.
But he had that pressure because that's what a lot of people said, you know, when he was coming at, you know, trying to come into the league. Would a team owner want to take him to the country club to play golf?
Not at that time.
And we know how country clubs are to this day.
Yeah.
So, especially and then back then, like, no, like, that's what he had to fight. That's what he knew he was trying to break through. So, to be putting up these numbers and to be going through all that, that says something that people don't really, I think, truly want to grasp and understand. Like, there's pressure in that limelight for all quarterbacks, but it's different when, hey, you're the first. We haven't seen anyone like you. And you know what? You know that you're carrying the burden.
He's the barometer.
Yeah. He's carrying it. He's thinking about those people before him. He didn't get a chance. And he's thinking about the little kids, you know, the young Mike Vicks.
Yeah.
Or Aaron Brooks or Dante Culpepper.
Aaron Brooks.
Yeah, you got to throw out Aaron Brooks. All, you know, Donovan McNabbs. He's thinking about those guys coming after him, too. The Mahomes, Russell Wilson. He's thinking, if I don't make it, as hurting these guys. That's a pressure that, you know, let's be real, John Elway's not going through. Dan Marino's not, they're not going through that.
Not even close. So what's funny is we're talking about how pure of a passer he is, and you know, he was your prototypical passer, but he also came in with Houston. He was 27 years old. So, yeah, he was in the prime of his career. But if you look at his rushing totals, right, let's say in Edmonton, and not to say he was not a running quarterback. We know that. But he was still putting up, you know, he put up 527 yards his last season, 3 touchdowns. The season before that in 82, he put up almost 300 yards rushing. So that he had the ability to move and run around still, and him being a pure pocket passer. We're not talking like that about Dan Marino. We're not talking about that with Jim Kelly, even though Jim Kelly early on in his career can move a little bit. But, you know, he was a total package, you know. And the thing is, like, for him to have to wait till he was 27 years old to come into the league to play as a rookie, it's embarrassing for the NFL. Like, the NFL should be embarrassed based off his career.
Absolutely, for sure. And, you know, so we talked about that embarrassing loss the Oilers had. You know, it's known as the comeback in that 92 wild card game at Buffalo. Frank Reich, maybe, in my opinion, he's like my favorite coach right now. He's that guy. I love Frank Reich as a coach.
He won the Eagles at Super Bowl, by the way.
Absolutely. And so, we'll, you know, I think he's going to do – he is doing great work in Indy with the Colts, and I think he'll continue to do that. But got to be honest, his name, he had that great comeback, Maryland. We talk about Jimmy Johnson. We love Jimmy, but Frank Reich did it twice. He had a comeback on the Hurricanes, Jimmy Johnson's first year, and then this comeback. So Frank Reich's the comeback kid.
And I remember in that telecast, they brought that up.
Yeah.
Like at halftime, I think it was. They brought up, they showed highlights of Frank Reich throwing touchdowns in Maryland against, you know, like you said, the Hurricanes. And, you know, what if he does this again? And then, boom, this is what happens.
So after that devastating loss, a lot of changes. You got Buddy Ryan.
Buddy.
He gets brought in as defensive. Now, Jack Pardee's the head coach. Buddy gets brought in as defensive coordinator, and I'll be honest, I think the foundation was like, it was built on sand, not rock, for the old
wet
biblical
sand
parable. But like, I look at like a lot of the issues that wound up happening during 93, and a big part of it to me, I'm looking at, and I love Buddy, but like Buddy caused a lot of these issues.
He was probably the main issue.
Yes.
With that 93 Oilers team. And, you know, you're Jack Pardee, and they did a great job in that Football Life. He's on his show, and that's how he finds out.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the owner just goes ahead, doesn't even say anything to him, and hires Buddy Ryan as a defensive coordinator. Now, we all know Buddy's a great defensive mind. So, and somebody in that Football Life kind of mentioned it. It's like, immediately, you're showing Buddy Ryan that you don't got to worry about Jack Pardee.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's not calling the shots. You probably report to me. Don't worry about it. Just do your job. Get this defense where it needs to be so we can go ahead and win the Super Bowl. And everybody was picking the Oilers to get to the Super Bowl. It was Dallas and Houston's Super Bowl. Everybody was picking that
Texas Super Bowl.
Yeah.
Saying.
Which would have been a really great Super Bowl to watch. But
over your Bills again for the fourth year in a row? You sure?
Yeah, over that team, that Bills team, yeah.
I'm just making sure.
That's cool. The Bills, I mean, just immediately there's like, is issues with bringing Buddy in. And then, like you mentioned, like Buddy just starts doing Buddy stuff and, you know, divides the team where he pretty much does everywhere he went. I mean, especially Chicago. We all know the story about that. We, you know, we did all, you can check our show, check the archives on that. And then even in Philly, it was like the defense versus the offense. It's like a straight division. And he did the same thing with this Houston Oilers team. That defense, which had really didn't have too many big names, they were playing pretty well. But, you know, it was just a straight division. That defense hated the offense, vice versa. He hated Kevin Gilbride. Kevin Gilbride hated Buddy Ryan. And every practice was like vicious. And like they were hitting Warren Moon, even though he had the red shirt on. It was nuts, man. And people looking at it, they went on that long winning streak, but it was still like a shit show.
I think it helped me. I don't know if there's – I'm only thinking of two, and I think this one is crazier still, but I don't know if a team in the NFL history had a crazier season than Houston Oilers 93.
No, I don't – I can't think of anybody. Even those Dallas teams were nuts,
no,
but this has nothing –
they were still focused. They still the.
But that's because of coaching.
Yeah. And it went off the rails once you had Barry Switzer in there.
Exactly.
But the only thing I think of is in Football Life did a season, an episode on this, Cleveland 95, when they knew they were leaving.
Yeah.
And the team was moving. But I still don't think that's as crazy as what we had here.
Nah.
I mean, it's just so much stuff from, you know, like Jose mentioned, those practices and being cheap and dirty. And Buddy winds up calling practice. And he's the D coordinator. He sends everyone in as a D coordinator. To just, it wind up getting, you know, the owner, Bud Adams, who I don't blame him for feeling this way. I blame him for making it public where he, before the season starts, he says, if it doesn't happen this year, I'm blowing the team up.
Yeah, you can't do that.
So that already, you know, that's.
You can blow the team up. You can't say that.
Don't say it. You know, everyone looks at the last dance. There were so many last dances before the last dance. Like, you know what I mean? That's why I'm like, yeah, I mean, the Bull, it's Michael. I get it. But I'm like, a lot of teams did that where it's like, you know, if you don't win now, everyone's going. Like, I'm tired of getting close.
Yeah.
You know, so it's just bad with that. And then there's just so many things, just some nasty fights between the offense and defense, like you said. And then from, you know, we have it gets like kind of like, I don't know, political or social with paternity stuff.
Yeah,
Babygate. And
what are your thoughts on that?
Oh, it's insane. It's insane because it still lasted after that in the NFL.
Yeah.
But it's insane that
everybody was talking about.
Yeah,
that.
It's insane that if a player wants to be there, he's going to miss a game to be for the birth of his child, or like right after, I guess, the birth of his child.
Well, it was David Williams. He was an offensive tackle for the Oilers. He wanted to be there for the birth of his child. Cool. Like, where he was catching, like, shit from the, like, teammates. It was like he was, you know, the child was born, but he was still wanted to stay home for, like, a couple of days afterwards, where the understanding was, you'll be there before the baby's born, be there when the baby's born, and then we expect you to come in time for the game.
The only thing I can give the Oilers, because especially from watching the telecast of the playoff game, the Oilers Chiefs game that we're going to be talking about, was there was miscommunication on David Williams' part, and he didn't say that was his plan. So I can see being, especially, you know, at that point, we're in the doesn't seem that far, but 93,
yeah.
We still were, our thinking was like, all right, yeah, the dad's, he's there for the birth, but that's it. Like, you go to work, that's it.
Misplaced priorities, Bud Adams.
Yeah. So,
yeesh.
That's the only thing I can get. Other than that, the Oilers just look bad. You know, yeah. You have coaches saying, hey, it's like war. Would you go to World War II? And, oh, you know, your brothers are getting ready to go to battle, but I can't go. My wife just had a baby. Like, it's like you're comparing war to this. And then,
yeah.
You know, how many football games has David Williams been a part of his whole life from Pee Wee up to now? But then the birth of his child and being there, and, you know, it's a shame. He missed. They took away a game check for him.
$111,000. He was fined.
Yeah.
Yeesh.
And Al Gore, you know, he's vice president. He got involved and he gave his opinion. And I remember when Randall, when his twins were born, and people saying, oh, should he go? Is he going to make it back in time? And
I thought you were going to say the Whitney Houston date. That's what I was like. That's a little different.
Yeah. Hey. No one faults Randall for that now. No one faults Randall. That was a big deal, too.
That was a huge deal.
People don't talk about that as much. That was a big deal, Randall and Whitney. But that was just one thing you had. That was just, and you would think, oh, wow, that alone, it's like, that's a big controversial thing.
That takes a lot of folks.
That might be like third or fourth.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like with Jeff Ault, he winds up killing himself tragically. You know, he was intoxicated and he had his best friend in the car. And he's driving, and they lose control, and his best friend goes through the windshield and dies. And he's calling 911, and he's frantic. And once he realizes his friend died, he sadly, you know, fired a few shots in tribute to his friend and then took his own life. And that happens later on in the year.
Yeah.
And it's crazy. You know, Warren Moon gets benched for Cody Carlson.
Cody Carlson.
And so people are, because Warren is at that, like Jose said, he's 27 when he came out, so he's 36
this season, yeah.
And still killing it, but then people are looking to point the finger and blame because they start the year 1-4. They're not blaming it on lack of, like, Bud Adams speaking out. They're not blaming it on that Jack Pardee's not taking charge. Or it could be a combination of that or slash Buddy Ryan, the way he got brought in probably was like, hey, you just answer to the owner or the GM.
Yeah.
Don't worry about Jack. Now they're pointing at Warren Moon.
Yeah, which is, I mean, look, he's the quarterback, right? Like, I understand that. But the defense wasn't playing well. You know, they kind of, Buddy's system is pretty complicated. You know, we've heard a lot of players talk about that. You know, even from the 85 Bears, like, all those Bears players were saying, like, how they had to dumb it down. Like, Mike Singletary was talking about that a lot. And, you know, we were hearing stuff like that in Philly. But, you know, so I understand, like, that defense may take a little time to get rolling. But, you know, they lost to New Orleans that first game when they thought they were just going to walk in and blow them out. Ironically, they blow the Chiefs out in week two, and then they lose the next.
With no Montana.
With no Montana, though. And then they lose the next two games. And that's when, like you said, like, they bench Warren Moon. Cody Carlson gets hurt. That's the only reason Moon comes back in the game. And that's when they go on this all-time great run.
11-game win streak. Unbelievable.
And they were rolling, too. Like,
and I think that needs to be talked about. Like, I know, like, hey, we get it. Like, hey, there's expectations. There's a lot of talent on this team. But to go through all those things, all that stuff, you start 1-4. You bench your quarterback. Their backup is – they say Cody was playing well.
Yeah.
But he gets hurt.
He blows his hamstring.
Yeah. Warren Moon.
Poor guy.
Poor
man.
Guy. That could have been – who knows. But
yeah.
Warren comes back in. You go on an 11-game win streak – with baby gate, with a teammate tragically taking his own life, with coaches going at it and arguing on this, and, you know, the defensive coordinators calling out the wide receivers and receivers, Ernest Givens fired back, which I was happy. Good job, Ernest.
Yeah, he was a fiery dude.
Yeah, you know, and you're calling out Kevin Gilbride. You go through all that. Hell, the last game of the year, you're – defensive coordinator Buddy Ryan swings at Kevin Gilbride, your offensive coordinator.
On ESPN,
on
prime time, yes. Man, and everybody saw that. So the crazy part about that, right, is, you know, now after that, every shot, every time something happens on offense, the next camera is, boom, on Buddy Ryan. Boom, on it. But this game that we're going to talk about, the divisional game in 93 with KC, after every third down, the first thing they did, boom, they showed Buddy Ryan's reaction. almost after every third down. It was insane, like how they were pushing that and pushing that and pushing that. And that's a, it's a big deal. But man, like these networks were having a field day with that.
Well, you, if you don't know any better, you think Buddy Ryan's the head coach of the Houston Oilers. You don't, you don't hear them mention Jack Pardee hardly throughout that broadcast.
No,
it's Buddy, Buddy, Buddy. And the thing is, I remember I didn't see that live, that punch.
Yeah, I did.
But for so long, it gets hyped up like he barely got him. It wasn't even like he nicked him. And let's be real, Buddy, you know, he's a, back in the day, maybe he was younger. He, you know, I know he fought in the Korean War, tougher. He's a tough-nosed guy.
Yeah.
But whether it was with Mike Ditka or Kevin, like, Buddy knew what he was doing because Ditka would have kicked his ass. And Kevin
Grobe was about to whoop his ass.
He's going
to
kick his ass, too. So Buddy kind of had it orchestrated. He had, like, cops and his players around him and stuff.
Buddy ain't stupid.
No, Buddy knows. You know, he wants to keep that image up, and it's – they're going through all that, and they, you know, so all this is happening on this 11-game win streak and going 12-4 and, you know, getting the number two seed in the AFC. So all this is going into that, that crazy divisional round game, you know, with the Chiefs and the Oilers.
Yeah, that's insane to think about, man. Like, all that stuff happening in one season, and it, there's no, you know, there's no surprise, like you mentioned, like, you know, they had a football life based off of that. And again, because from the outside looking in, like, you look at this team and you're like, man, like, this team has it all together. 9 Pro Bowl selections that season. And like you mentioned, like, we were talking about some of these wide receivers. Like, you, yeah, Hayward Jeffries was a Pro Bowler. Warren Moon made it to the Pro Bowl after that terrible start. Bruce Matthews, again, Hall of Famer. Greg Montgomery. Ray Childress, who was pretty good at this time. Mike Munchak, you mentioned, Hall of Famer. Sean Jones was pretty good. And then Webster Slaughter, I was shocked by that because he was getting pretty old at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he makes it to the Pro Bowl. 9 Pro Bowl selections, man. Like, this team was stacked, you know. And even if you look at, like, that year's draft, we talked about Brad Hopkins, Michael Barrow, you know, Blaine Bishop, who played a long time with Tennessee and stuff. Good. Like, you know, it, they had – this roster was loaded, man, and they had no business not getting to the Super Bowl. But, again, we'll get into why they didn't make it. And – they should have still won that game.
In this game, you know, the Chiefs come in. They have beat the Steelers in a wild card game like the week before, an overtime game. But, you know, Joe Montana, people kind of think he was, you know, this is his first really full season starting quarterback since that hit in the 90 championship game against the Giants when he's with San Fran and Leonard Marshall.
Yeah, he missed the 2 previous seasons.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. You know, so this, and then the Chiefs also trade for Hall of Fame running back Marcus Allen. So there's big names, you know, so people are kind of feeling Marty Ball's getting like a little electrified, but still no one gave them a chance going into this game, going down to Houston. Houston's so hot right now, 11-4. It was, people were thinking, looking like the playoffs, like it's, like we said earlier, all Texas Super Bowl, but the Chiefs had a little something different in mind.
Yeah, and you know, you talked about those, you know, those two players, but looking at this game, so yeah, let's just get into the game then. Yeah, so let's, you know, looking at, and I'm looking at these players on the Chiefs, right? And you have a rookie, Will Shields was a rookie. They had a really
future
good
Hall of Famer.
Future Hall of Famer, really good offensive line. But that defense was also stacked. You know, everybody came coming into this game was talking about Houston, Buddy's defense, Buddy Ball, all this stuff. When you do things like that, man, like other teams take that personally. And when you have Derek Thomas, Neil Smith. Albert Lewis is a name I forgot about.
I can't forget Albert. I love Albert Lewis.
I loved Albert Lewis. Like, Dan Salimua. Like, they had so many really, really good players. And this is Derek Thomas, like, in the middle of his prime. Like, this is, like, all-pro, all-time great Derek Thomas. Like,
yeah, he's probably, I think, at this point, if I'm going to rank, he's the third best. I'm going to put him behind Reggie and Bruce Smith.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's about it at this at 93. And, like, honestly, even in that era, that 90 to, like, 95, I look at Reggie. I would probably say at this point.
In the 93 season, he's close. He might be passing Bruce Smith at this
there,
point.
I would probably still give it to Bruce. I think he's ahead of Charles Haley.
Yeah.
At this point.
Yeah.
And Charles Haley's great.
Oh, yeah.
And we know what Charles Haley winds up, you know, being impactful a couple dynasties. But at 93, if you're saying who do I take, DT or Charles Haley, I'm gonna go with Derek Thomas.
No, absolutely. I wouldn't. I have no argument there. Man, this, and again, he took over this game in the fourth quarter. But
and that's what Jose is referencing with, you know, Brad Hopkins wound up being a really good left tackle, yeah. but they didn't really help him out.
They left him on the island out there. And, he, you know, because at first they were giving him some help, and then I guess they started feeling themselves, and he must have been feeling himself. And then that second half, I would say mid-third quarter, the whole fourth quarter, Derek Thomas was all over the place. But, again, I don't want to jump ahead too much, but, you know, just looking at this game, man, like this is exactly what Houston wanted. They wanted to be at home with that Astrodome, with that crowd. You know, that crowd was loud as hell with that defense.
That terrible music, that Houston. They had that. I was like, God. So they had that, you know, that terrible theme song was with them too because it'll put a team to sleep. So they had that for sure.
And then looking at that Chiefs offense, man, Montana looked old.
He did.
Like, you know, like you look at guys now like Brady and all these, like Big Ben, and, you know, they're playing in their late 30s, Brady in his early 40s, and like, they still look athletic. Man, Montana looked like he was 68 years old.
Yeah,
out there.
And like, I'm glad you said that, though, because, like, early on, it's Houston's game, and they're blitzing. Buddy is blitzing the hell out of Montana. And that's not a bad, as like you said, Will Shields, that's not a bad Chiefs offense. So that's a good Chiefs O-line.
Yeah.
But they're sending people left and right, and Joe just looks like he's frail and just, like, you're just like, cover up, Joe. Like, look out. Like, it just looks like, is he going to make it through the game?
It was like every other hit, he was getting up slow. It was like his hand. Then it was like his left knee. He was getting beat down. But the problem was Houston changed that and then stopped blitzing him really in the second half, which I didn't even understand. But I didn't get what Buddy did in that game. Like, it was weird because, again, like you mentioned, like, Houston should have been up by like 20 points in that first half, and they weren't. And they all, you know, we always hear that can't keep a team close, like don't give them that confidence, and that's exactly what they did, and it came back to bite them in the ass.
Well, I agree with you. Part of me just, you know, wondering, because we look at in the first, you know, it's a defensive game, and KC is, they're getting Marty Ball's aggressive. Usually when I think of Marty Schottenheimer's defense is, I don't think of blitzing as much, but KC, I think, I don't know if it was like trying to stick it up. You know, Marty gets real fire. He doesn't like those fiery personalities. You know how Marty felt about Al Davis? I don't know if this is like, you know, Jerry Glanville, stick it up yours, buddy.
Yeah.
Because like Marty starts blitzing all over too a little bit.
Yeah.
And I was kind of surprised. That's not typical Marty Ball, but it's a 10-0 Oilers game. And in that first half, the Chiefs have some near like connections on some deep throws that like just were a little bit like overthrown or just kind of got broken up. And part of me wonders, did Buddy kind of see that and then think, I'm going to play back more? Because this could have been like a 10-0 at the half. It could have been a 14-10 Chiefs half those plays were right there if they would have connected.
Yeah, I think, I don't know if it was the first half. I think Willie Davis drops that touchdown pass. He was wide open. It was like he had like a 10-yard cushion on the DB. Hit him right in the hands, drops it. You know, and that could, again, that would have been another touchdown. And, you know, the Chiefs couldn't do nothing offensively. They couldn't run the ball. You know, we mentioned like Montana being beat up, but they were going deep a lot. So they, credit to Kansas City, man. Like, you know, and then I think Bubba McDowell gets hurt in the second quarter. So that kind of hurt that defense too. So that might have been another thing that
he got hurt pretty early.
Yeah, he hurt his shoulder and they kind of kept him in the game, which didn't pay off later on. But, you know, it was Montana had a lot of misses in his first half. I think he was like 9 for 20 in the first half. He had a really bad first half. Threw a terrible interception in that first quarter. You know, that led to a field goal right of the first 3 points. But Al DelGreco, man.
Al DelGreco, that's a name.
That's a name I've talked said in a while.
And he was with that franchise for a long time.
Yeah.
He stayed there for a long, like when, once they became Tennessee. And Al DelGreco was there for a long time.
Yeah, and then, you know, like we kept talking about it, man. Like the Chiefs were really beating up Montana, man. Marcus Allen wasn't really doing anything. You know, you're looking at this game thinking, like, man, like, you know, these are some older players. Like, you know, are they going to be able to handle this pressure and all that? But like you mentioned, like Marty was blitzing the hell out of Warren Moon too. That Oilers offensive line was banged up, you know, so you had that. So they were getting pressure on Warren Moon. I think they had 9 sacks, like a Chiefs record for this game, but. So they were both defenses were playing really well.
They really were. But I look at it, and it goes back to just mentally, all this stuff can wear on you. So when you have a unit, we don't have to go back to, we'll keep it in the calendar year of 93 going like that. This is January 94. So in 1 year, you gave up, you had the worst collapse in a game, in a playoff game ever, 35-3. Then you heard us talk about what they were going through, all the craziness throughout the year. To me, when you have Keith Cash get that touchdown from Montana early in the third, make it 7-10. And I do love it when love when players do that, when they spike it up against the wall. But they had that big, like, which was actually a pretty good, like,
it was a great, like
drawing of Buddy. Like, it was pretty accurate. It was pretty nice. But he goes up and just throws like a dart at it, like at that drawing. And it's like, hey, we're here. It's like a punctuation thing.
I think he even spit at it too. It looked like he did.
It like took the air out of the Astrodome and also out of the Oilers. I feel like, here we go again.
Yeah,
and that's what I felt. That they're still winning, but like that was like so huge.
And this was an NBC game, right?
Yeah, you had Dick Enberg and Bob Trumpy.
Yeah, but after halftime, they throw it to the sideline reporter. Who? O.J. Simpson.
Oh, yeah.
I was like,
the juice is loose.
The juice is loose. I don't know what the hell he was talking about. He was talking about we gotta make the balls. And I was like, what? Like,
O.J.'s terrible. He was never a good broadcast. He was terrible. No. Not a good actor. Surprisingly good actor.
He was. Naked Gun, he played his part.
Yeah, as a broadcaster. He's terrible in the booth, terrible on the sideline.
That just caught me off guard. I totally forgot about that. And they were throwing it to O.J. And I was like, what? Like, and Todd Christensen with his hair. Like, it was great, man. This was really fun to watch, but you're exactly right. That's when the tide turned.
Yeah.
Like that play, that touchdown play, and then that reaction, I think it just got the Chiefs going. They made those adjustments, so they weren't really throwing the ball deep anymore. It was like a true West Coast offense they were running. Like those tight end like outs, like those quick shit. Like it was really fun to watch. And then now Montana, the second half, he starts rolling. He had a really good second half. But now they're like dinking dunking them now, like, you know, and this Chiefs offensive line starts to play a lot better. And like we mentioned earlier, Jeremy, like you mentioned, it seemed like Buddy kind of took his foot off the gas with that blitz. So Montana was getting a little bit of time. But even when they dialed up that 46 blitz, man, like they were still getting to him. So I was really surprised that they just didn't keep that going.
Let me ask you, how much, I know Buddy's all bravado, how much is the ghost of Montana? But he had some tough losses to Joe. Yeah.
I was thinking about that, you too. Know? That 90, was that 90 in Philly? 89.
That's 89. That, because that 89 Niners team is so great.
Yeah.
And that, like, punctuates. I've seen people out in the West Coast talk about that team. They go, that game in Philadelphia, South, it always hurts, too. I'm like, geez.
Wait, Montana threw what, 4 touchdown passes in the fourth quarter?
And they were hitting them. Like, Buddy, like, Reggie and Clyde and everybody, they were getting after Joe. They were hitting them all over the vet, but...
And it was that one NFL film shot where he threw that bomb to Rice, and they had it was a great shot. Like, they just had it was like behind Montana. You could see that arc, and Rice just ran right under it in stride on that post route touchdown. Yeah, that was a heartbreaker.
Yeah,
there.
Joe had success against Buddy's 46. So part of me just wonders, it was like they had some near misses in the first half.
Yeah.
And also at this point, Joe Montana, you know, he's Joe Montana at this point. Like, Jose's right. He looked older and
slower. He was 37 years old.
You know, which is a year older than Warren.
Yeah, but and that was a big difference in that age.
Totally big difference, right? Warren looked like, he belongs out there, like fresh. Yeah, Joe, yeah. Joe had a punctured, like, rib.
He was all messed up.
You heard, like, Bob Trump, he said, it's hard for him to breathe. And I'm like, that's not good. That's not good. Like,
you need to breathe.
Yeah, he's like, he says he sits down and... Well, as long as he doesn't have to do anything, he can breathe okay. Yeah, but anything he has to do, he struggles to breathe. And I'm like, that's not good. And I'm like, and then you just see him just getting hit all over the place. I'm like, oh, geez.
He was struggling. But he started to play well in that second half.
That Montana magic.
I'll give him that. But the Chiefs also started running the ball a little more effectively with Marcus Allen. He was finding some lanes in there. And, you know, but that Chiefs defense – took over that game in the second half. And Houston had some moments there, especially in the fourth quarter. Warren Moon had a beautiful drive. But, man, they were starting to get the Warren, for real.
Well, and then what happened with that, they're getting the Warren, they're causing turnovers.
Exactly.
You know, they're hitting them, and then he's starting to get they're stripping him. He's, you know, giving the ball up. And those turnovers were key for getting Kansas City back in that game. And that's where you talk about those sacks. Derek Thomas and that rush was really huge for him. And to me, like, I don't know – I think for a while people were blaming Warren Moon. I don't know if you hear that as much now, yeah. But how can you blame Warren Moon for that when, like, he's getting swarmed by, you know, future Hall of Famer like Derek Thomas.
And a really good Neil Smith.
Really good.
Really good Neil Smith. And then Dan Solomon right up the middle, big guy.
I love Dan Solomon.
Yeah, he was a good player. He was a really, really good player. He can push that pocket in. And what he was doing, you couldn't really step up. Now you got to step back a little bit, and you got Derek Thomas, Neil Smith coming after you. So, no, that Chiefs defense was really, really good. But again, the biggest problem that the Oilers have, and we talked about that earlier, they could not run the ball in this game.
No.
Like, they had zero running game. So now you have a banged up O-line. They were talking about Munchak was, like, banged up. You know, they had a couple other players banged up. You had a rookie left tackle, you know, and you can't run the ball.
Mm-hmm.
Gary Brown is going nowhere.
And he had a good year.
He had to ran for 1,000 yards. You know, he took over for Lorenzo White. And, you know, so he definitely had a big game. But they just couldn't – if they were not throwing the ball, they were not getting any yards. And if you have a defense like that with that pass rush – you're one-dimensional, it's over, man. They got you exactly where they want you.
No, absolutely. And I think, you know, get capped off with a Marcus Allen game-clinching 21-yard.
Beautiful run.
Marcus Allen, he's unlike Joe because by his age in running back years, you're thinking he should be old. But, you know, that whole controversy with Al Davis.
And Bo Jackson took over. Yeah,
he the previous, like, 5 years, he's not playing. Or he plays, like, fullback and blocks for Bo, or he's on the bench. Like, so Marcus Allen is actually pretty fresh at this point.
Yeah, he has some fresh legs, yep.
You know, so it's just – I'll be honest, though, for me, in hindsight, it's not as bad of a loss. And I'm not even talking – it's because of – those Chiefs teams were really good teams, and they're kind of in that same category of we're talking about the Chiefs and all the talent that they have, and they're in that same boat of, like, why didn't they get to a Super Bowl,
you know,
with Marty? So, like, looking – in the moment, it feels, like, way worse. But looking back, those Chiefs were building something that for a while, throughout the rest of the decade, they were a contender. They were AFC West champs and a people's picks that, hey, they – you know, the Super Bowl should be going through Arrowhead, and it never really happened for them. But looking back, it's like, no, that's like we're saying, that's a talented Chiefs team that they lost to.
Yeah, yeah, looking back is not – it's just, I guess, you know, that run Houston was on with 11 straight and a home playoff game, like, that is still a bad loss, you know. And then the way they were playing in that first half, that's where they lost the game. They should have – you know, we mentioned the Chiefs had a couple opportunities, but – you know, the Oilers, again, they had a couple opportunities, too. They had a couple turnovers, and, you know, they kicked field goals. And, you know, with a guy like Montana, who's going to make things happen, no matter how bad he looked, no matter how old he was, you got to put the ball in the end zone. And, you know, even Kansas City, those last three possessions, they were all touchdowns. So, you know, they made the adjustment. Again, going back to what we were talking about earlier in the show, Houston coaching staff could not, and they had no answer for what the Chiefs came out with in that second half, and on both sides, on offense and defense, and that's where the game was lost.
Yeah, you give up 21 in the fourth. You know, it's 7-10 game going into that quarter, then you give up 21 fourth quarter points, and that's the difference. And the Chiefs went up winning 28-20, and that's the end of an era. Who knew that it's only – I mean, Bud Adams had said he's breaking up the team, and he did, including – his Pro Bowl, All-World, All-Pro quarterback, Warren Moon, but that this is really the end of an era for a while of football in Houston.
Yeah, like, that's the thing. Like, not only does this team not make the playoffs, I mean, make the playoffs, but, like, underachieves, let's just say, but then, man, like, those fans were out of there. Like, it was bad. Like, you know, yeah, they broke up the team, but then the fans just said, you know what, we're done with this team, and they were not showing up. Even that, I'm trying to remember what year it was, that they couldn't even televise the game because the Astrodome wasn't sold out.
Yeah.
It just got really bad. And, you know, he was saying, like, you know, if this doesn't change, I don't get a new, you know, stadium, whatever, I'm going to move this team. And he does that.
And it's crazy because you got to look at it. At this point, it's early 94, but Houston, they don't have the Rockets winning yet. They don't have – so that you have Houston had – you know, we did it, check our archives – like the 1980, that heartbreaking loss to the Phillies in the LCS. You had the five slam a jammer run where they go three straight Final Fours and heartbreaking losses, can't get the job done. And then you have these Oilers, you know, the Astros kind of fade out. The Astros losing 86 to the Mets.
To the Mets,
in a heartbreaking fashion. Then you have these Oilers who are close but no cigar time after time. So the city of Houston kind of has that mentality. You know, we saw it with the Rockets later on, like when they're down 2-0 to the Suns in the 94 playoff, you know, choke city. So that's what the city is kind of thinking. Like, we're a city of chokers. We're a city that can't get the job done. And part of me feels like that's because we know we see Houston, Texas, they love football.
Yeah.
But I think it's a mentality of like you get sick and tired of getting your hopes up and getting let down. And maybe this year. And then it's bad enough when one franchise has that. But then when all your teams and even your college basketball team has that, kind of like it can kind of take a toll. And we know that. I think a lot of cities know that when it's like you just feel like you can't get a break with any team. It does wear on you mentally, like to an extent. As a sports fan, it shouldn't hopefully wear on you overall in your life, but as a sports fan, it can wear on you.
And I also think it does that to players, too.
For sure.
You know, and I felt like with this Oilers team, we talked about, and you talked about it earlier, Jeremy, like everything that they went through this season, but not only this season, the season before giving up that huge lead and losing like an all-time, that was an all-time bad loss, right? So now, once this game, once things start to turn around, and like we mentioned, like that snowball starts, like they didn't have any answers. You know, even though in that fourth quarter, you know, Moon took him down. It was a beautiful drive. He completed like eight passes in a row. But you knew, like it just, you knew this was coming. You know what I'm saying? Like you knew the Chiefs were going to score again, and you know Montana was going to do something to make a big play. But I feel like with players, and especially like this team. Like, once that turnaround came from the Chiefs, it was like, you know, here we go again.
Yeah.
And what can we do about it? We can't do anything. And we're going to lose again. And that was it. Like, so I'm not surprised at how bad it got in Houston after this season. But, man, it like that's like all-time bad. Like, you have a terrible season, 94, then the team is gone.
Yeah.
You know, and it goes to, and then they have this all this success in Tennessee.
Absolutely.
Which makes it even worse because they draft McNair.
Eddie like, George is there.
Eddie George, like, man, like, that makes it even worse for me. You know what I'm saying? Like, even, like, those Browns team that, you know, that Browns team that moved to Baltimore. And
the
like,
Ravens win in 2000.
And then the Ravens go on all this success and continue to have success. That's got to even crush you even more as a fan.
Oh, yeah, because in the same, like you said, like, I know for both the Oilers, you know, you look at for that franchise and, like, the Browns, those pieces, those cornerstones of that success were a part of when you were like in that previous place, like with the Browns.
Yeah,
they were looking at drafting Ray Lewis when they were still in Cleveland. He was their guy to pick.
Yep.
Like, yeah, you know what I mean? Like, and you look at Cleveland, he winds up, even once they redo the franchise and bring it back, he's torturing them. And it's like, he should be wearing a Browns jersey.
Yeah.
You know, Jonathan Ogden should be wearing a Browns jersey.
Ozzie Newsome is their GM and he's like one of the best GMs of all time.
Exactly.
Like,
you know, and that's how you can feel. Air McNair, that was the third pick of the 95 draft. Yeah, Eddie George is a Heisman winner from that school in Ohio. Like, all
Ohio
those
State.
Things. Ugh. But I like Eddie George despite he's from Philly, but it goes to Ohio State. So I'm like torn. The city I love and then the school I hate the most. But all that's there in Houston, and then you wind up seeing them be a consensus, like, division winner throughout the rest of the decade and get to the Super Bowl. Which they could never do when Houston could never get to the bowl.
I forgot about that. They even went, you said it, they got to the Super Bowl, the all-time great Super Bowl.
Great game.
Almost won that game. Had great players, McNair, Eddie George, Yvonne Curse. Like, they just had a lot of great players.
Brad Hopkins, who was drafted here.
He was solid. He was super solid for that team. Like, you know, they on and on and on. Like, and they had a lot of good players. And to see that, like, that team leave your city and have that success – had to be really tough. But again, like, then later on they get, you know, another franchise in Houston, the Texans, and, you know, that beautiful stadium. You know, they're hosting Super Bowls, but not for their team, but they're Houston. they're hosting Super Bowls. So, you know, that fan base has something now. And, you know, Houston, again, like you talked about, the Rockets has a couple championships. You know, you had the Rockets with Harden, like, have a lot of success. You know, the Texans have some success. They're going through some stuff now, but they have some success. So it's like, you know, for Houston, like, all right, we bounced back a little bit, but this run here was really tough. Like, it had to be really tough as a football fan to watch and to go through. But this team was so, so good, man. Like, there is no reason why they should not have at least won one Super Bowl or got to a Super Bowl.
You know what I look at, though?
Or AFC Championship game.
Yeah, true. I look at it. We talk about Warren Moon and the Trailblazers. You know, he's a big part of that. But if they go to the Super Bowl, are the – I think the Oilers stay in Houston.
Oh, yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Even if they lose to the Cowboys, but they go. Some people say they win this game. Just getting to a championship game, some people even said that might have kept them in Houston. I don't know. But I think definitely a bowl berth, which I think they could have beaten Bills that next week. It would have been a good game.
But it would have been a good game, but they had the opportunity.
Bills were kind of on the way down for that fourth Super Bowl run.
And then Houston would have had home field advantage, I believe. No.
That was in Atlanta. Yeah, that was in Atlanta, that Super Bowl. But it's
No, what I mean, like, for that AFC Championship game.
Oh, I thought Houston had the number two seed.
To the Bills, yeah.
But isn't it something that Warren Moon's a trailblazer, and with all this, when Bud Adams does do what he says, blows up the team, it paves the way for Aaron McNair, the late, great Steve McNair, to come in. And it's something that, you know, Steve McNair probably grew up watching Warren Moon, and who knows if where McNair goes. If, you know, I think Warren Moon's definitely there in 94 and probably 95 if they get to the Super Bowl. So it's just interesting, but it's also like he paved that way. And that trailblazer for another great young black quarterback to come after him and take that mantle. So even in, like, this tough losing, like, he's still winning in that regard.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Because, like, without Warren Moon, is Bud Adams taking a Steve McNair? Is he feeling comfortable, like, seeing what he had with Warren, he takes an Aaron McNair?
Yeah, and there's trailblazers, there's guys who kick down the door, but there's guys who do that and do that real classy, you know, like, yeah, he had a couple off-the-field things, you know, the thing with his wife, you know, later on he has some other stuff, but he was a class act. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, he was like, you know, he's a guy who you would want to represent your franchise. Like, we talked about, like, take with the owner, take him to the country club. Like, that should be your guy. Like, that's a prototypical guy, you know, that you would want an owner to have that relationship with the top player in your team. But that's what I always used to look, even on, like, those 90s, like, quarterback challenges, like, all I used to love watching those. But he was always, like, he was, like, a good interview. He was, like, super well-spoken. Like, he was, like, really calm, had a great demeanor. And it was, like, you didn't really – he wasn't, like, a rah-rah guy on the field. It was just, like, throwing a touchdown, hands up, go to the sidelines. Like, that's what you want in a guy. Like, that's what you want in a quarterback. And it's, again, going back to what we talked about earlier, it's terribly sad that it took him – so he was 27 years old to come into the NFL and have to go through everything he went through. But, you know, he still had a great career in the NFL.
And despite everything and all that stuff, where he still ranks so high.
Yeah.
You know, and despite the way the game has evolved and been bumped up, he's still pretty high with the all-time passing yards in different categories. And imagine if he would have had those 5 years that he had to go to Canada.
Yeah.
You know, people add up his numbers. If you add up his Canada, his CFL, I know CFL, like you said earlier, it's a different league. But when people add those numbers up, he's still like a top five.
He's like a 60,000, something like that.
You know, in all these categories. And that's just how dominant, how innovative, and how great it is to, like you said, he stayed healthy.
Yeah.
You know, the hits that they were getting back then for him to play. And I remember he was fired up when Cody Carlson was taking his job. He's like, I'll show you, I'll outplay Cody. And he does.
Yeah, and outlast Cody in the league.
Yep.
And then in that offense, so it's, you know, it's the run and shoot offense. So there's no tight end. You know, we talked about the big back for pass protection, but, you know, he's getting hit in that offense. And for him to be as durable and play as long as he did, played for decades in the league, like, that's a long time, man. And then not only did he play, but he had – it was, like, solid. I mean, great and then solid towards the end. Of you know, as a playing career, because like we talked about in Minnesota, he had some couple good years, helped Chris Carter break the all-time, you know, receiving record in Minnesota. Again, in Seattle, he goes to a Pro Bowl. Man, Warren Moon was an all-time great player.
It needs to be remembered, and when we think about those great QBs of the 80s and even into the 90s, he shouldn't be dropped off, in my opinion, from an Elway or a Jim Kelly or Marino. You know, there's guys, Elway, I mean, not Elway, but Marino and Kelly don't have Super Bowls.
You hear about Bernie Kosar more than you hear about Warren Moon.
Yeah, Boomer size. People talk about Boomer and stuff.
Yeah.
No, we need to put Warren Moon right up there with these other guys, in my opinion, and not he should not be forgotten because, obviously, the off the field, what it meant socially, but just even on the field, he takes a back seat to none of those quarterbacks, in my opinion. Like, he's right there with all of them. Like, he could sling it with the best in such a great era for quarterback play. You know, it wasn't the downtime. This is, some people call it the height of quarterback play.
Absolutely.
They say the best era of that time, and Warren Moon's right there with them.
Yeah, and that's why, Jeremy, I love doing this show with you, man, because we can go ahead and pick who we want to talk about. And then when we brought Warren Moon up, it was like,
it was universal.
Yeah, it was like, this is a name. This is a topic that we have to discuss because that's what we do here at Bigger Than the Game podcast. Like, we talk about those guys that nobody talks about anymore, you know, and we bring them from the past. We bring them back right back to the present. And we let it be known that these guys had great careers and they need to be talked about. So, no, this was awesome, man.
No, that's well said. And that's the way to end it, man. So, for the one and only Jose Ruiz, I'm Jeremy Dove. Special shout-out to producer extraordinaire Vince Quinn.
You're the man, Vince.
Thank you guys for listening to Bigger Than the Game. Peace.
Peace.